Welcome to the Asymptote Podcast. This is part two of our special feature on mythology, and we're going to be focusing on two nations in Western Asia, Israel and Georgia, and thinking about some of the ways in which past and present collide in these cultures, both for good and for bad. But before we jump in, I want to quickly update you on our Indiegogo campaign. If you've glanced at our social media sites lately, you've probably seen that we're wholeheartedly rallying to raise enough funds to keep the journal going. And as I'm recording this, we've currently raised $8,353, which is amazing. Thank you so much for all your generous contributions. But we still have quite a way to go to hit our target of $25,000. So if you haven't donated yet, please consider helping us. You'd be playing a vital part in supporting the free and open sharing of world literature. Our fundraiser's deadline is January 29th, so there's not long left to get involved. The place to go for donations is www.indiegogo.com/projects/asymptote. Thank you. And with no further ado, let's kick off the episode by turning to Israel. Both recently and pretty much as far back as the nation has existed, the State of Israel has occupied a controversial space on the world stage. It's a country whose story differs wildly depending on who you ask about it, and that's no less true within the Israeli population itself. Our Israeli editor-at-large, Yarden Greenspan, grew up in Tel Aviv, and she has complicated feelings about her cultural heritage. Here's Yarden.
Growing up in Israel, you can become so immersed in a sense of history and current events that you might perceive your knowledge of the world, or even of your own country, as much deeper and more aware than it actually is. We grow up learning about Jewish heroes who claimed the land as their own, fighting against the Arabs who wanted us out of here. We're told that there's a distinction between Jewish and Israeli, and we're encouraged to think about which title we identify with more strongly. But the difference is invisible to us, because almost everyone we know is both. It's only later that we realize that there are other truths, truths that were conveniently understated during the years of our childhood, and remain untouched for many throughout their lives. We realize that our heroes did not simply claim land that had been earmarked for them. They took it away, sometimes violently, other times cunningly, from local Arab villagers. We realize that everything we have was bought with blood. At least this was my experience. Sometimes it feels like the entire process of growing up was, for me, focused on trying to figure out the two sides of every truth, to make myself feel more at home with the information I was absorbing and disseminating. And one of my sources of new views was, and still is, literature. So I thought it would be interesting to go to the disseminators of helpful and original information, to talk to writers about some of the myths that are all around us, and about the role that literature plays in shattering them. A few years ago, I started working with Gon Ben-Ari.
Israel is the place where most people print their own memoirs before they die.
Gon is a novelist and playwright who's currently working on a nonfiction project called Makarapo, What Happened Here. This project seems to be made for people like me, those who want an alternative to the myth.
If you have grandparents and you live in Israel, your grandparents right now are printing their own memoirs. And I take that as a sign that Israelis feel that they are not accurately represented and included in their history. And of course they're not. But suddenly, as you grow up in Israel, you start hearing about the Holocaust in Libya and the Holocaust in Tunisia and a lot of parts of Israeli history that were actually hidden from you because it did not serve the narrative that the state was trying to perpetuate.
So there you have it. I'm not alone here. I also spoke with another novelist, Ari Lieberman.
My name is Ari Lieberman. I teach comparative literature at the University of Georgia, and I grew up in Israel.
Right away, Ari touches on the most explosive myth, the myth of Israel as a land for Jews.
I would say the central myth of the Jewish or Israeli experience, and therefore of Hebrew literature, is the myth of the promised land. Israel is the ancestral homeland, you know, a place to reclaim and to return to. This is an idea that sustained the Jewish people for millennia.
The third author I talked to is Mati Friedman. Mati is a novelist and reporter who specializes in religion and archaeology. So what's the first myth that comes to Mati's mind?
I think that one of the main myths that you'll see in writing from this place is nostalgia. I think that Israelis and other observers of this country share the assumption that things here were once much better than they are today, that they were more perhaps ideologically pure, that people were motivated by loftier ideals.
Now, this is certainly something that's familiar to me. The idea that Israel used to be a naive, idyllic place before something undefined went very wrong. It's a notion you mainly hear from the older generation, but it's also evident in many songs that are still popular today.
There's one that's called "They Tell Me That Things Were Great Here Before I Was Born." That's the name of the song.
The big question, of course, is did things really used to be better? Or were we just being less honest with ourselves?
It might have been better for certain people, but I think it wasn't better for everyone. It's fine in Israel today to be gay. It's fine to be religious. It's fine to be Mizrahi, which means a Jew of Middle Eastern extraction.
So the next natural step here would be to ask, who are we really? Who are the dominant voices that are now slowly being overruled for the sake of the quiet majority?
Well, you know, there's a misconception that Jew and Arab are mutually exclusive categories. They can be one but not the other. But that's not true. We're all Levantines, and we're all pretty similar in many ways. And in fact, a great chunk of the Jewish population in Israel is of Arab descent.
It has become accepted both among Israel's friends and among Israel's enemies to view this country as kind of a European colonial implant. But if you know the country of Israel, you know that that's nonsense. Half of the Jews here come from the Middle East.
As both Mati and Ari point out, there's an incredible lack of awareness in this. If such a large part of our population is of Mizrahi descent, if so much of the food, atmosphere, and culture is influenced by Morocco, Iraq, Yemen, Persia, to name just a few, then why is so much of our national narrative focused on European Jews? We keep insisting on telling ourselves and others a specific kind of story.
A very simplistic story about what this country is about, a story that goes from Herzl through socialism and the kibbutz and the Holocaust, a story about Europe.
So the irony of, you know, when you see a mob chanting death to the Arabs, Mavet l'Arabim, you know that 90% of them are also Arabs. They just happen to be Jews.
Officially, Israel is located in Western Asia. It sits very close to the border between Asia and Europe, and many people like to refer to it as being in Europe. I suppose they feel it gives the country some kind of chic. And though we can't claim to be part of the United States, Israel is always kind of winking toward America, trying to become a small-scale model. This is especially true of Tel Aviv, the central city, the most modern and liberal city in Israel. Gon says that Tel Aviv is often portrayed as being as non-problematic as New York.
So living in Tel Aviv, you are living in a world that believes in rock and roll and the liberal paraphernalia of it, and you are perpetuating some image of the city, an image which is democratic, American, non-Middle Eastern. And because the city is written about so much and filmed so much, you're also perpetuating the symbol of the country.
So this leads us to the role of literature in all this, and to the power of art in general, to reinforce an existing narrative or to create a new subversive one. How does one find their way within these possibilities? How do you decide what to keep and what to get rid of?
I'd say that everything that is real about Israel is a secret. I mean, a secret to the foreigner who knows about Israel only through the news and advertising, propaganda. Everything that is not a cliche or a stereotype is a secret. And that's exactly, or at least one of the things that literature does, is exploit that and show you that.
But how? What's the best way to deliver the message literature is trying to put forth? What separates a literary writer from a news writer or from any kind of public figure whose ideas are heard by many? Gon says one big difference is that anyone who isn't a writer chooses to deliver information directly, which might not always be the most effective way.
The I Ching says evil cannot be dealt with directly. And the Gemara says you have to hate the Rabbanut, you have to hate the authority and love the craft, love the work. As well as the history of science and politics that would basically always claim that changes come from the outskirts, from the free thinkers, rather than from the limited thinkers of the mainstream.
Gon also warns against the unavoidable role we all play in enabling myths and the people who spread them. No matter how groundbreaking or subversive you're writing, you're still in the system, you're still playing the game.
Even the sheer act of publicly criticizing those in charge can be labeled as fig leafing, because by doing so you help those in charge portray themselves as allowing criticism. But the problem is that this line of reasoning is endless. It is almost impossible to move through this world without being a fig leaf for someone or something. If you make an Israeli film against Israel, do you help Israel change or do you help it approve its current being? Well, I believe you do both.
But there's hope.
But what I am saying is that this process ends up serving as a catalyst for ideas. This is how ideas happen, because when all of the people who think differently flee to one city, to Tel Aviv, they start communicating with each other and influencing each other and making art in Tel Aviv, and then they publish this art and spread their ideas back to the periphery, so there is evolution.
At any point in literature, there's always someone who's trying to tell a different story, pointing to a hopelessness beyond hope, or to a secret beyond common knowledge. I don't think this is unique to Israel. Every country has its myths, the agreed-upon truths that help keep its structure together. When the alternative truths do come out, they can be outrageous or overwhelming. I guess the only way to be informed is to take things into your own hands and try to get as full a picture as possible, assuming, of course, that it is possible.
I think it helps us get away from this mythic and very simplistic version of Israeli history.
And I think being Israeli, you mostly become aware of that, of the fact that ideology completely shapes the way you view the world.
Without this myth of a homeland to reclaim, there is no Zionism, there is no State of Israel, there is no Hebrew literary revival, and there is no Hebrew literature. So I think that Israel is a perfect place for shattered dreams. It's a place where you can really find great disillusion, because you have this ideal of the land of milk and honey, the promised land. It's always in the background, and it's always mocking your pitiful attempts to make it a reality.
But don't get too discouraged if you can't seem to pull yourself out of the myth. This is life, or at least, this is Israel.
That segment was written by Yarden Greenspan, and the authors you heard interviewed were Ari Lieberman, Gon Ben-Ari, and Matti Friedman. So next, we're going to be looking at a different element of cultural history altogether, the lifespan of a language. I'm going to hand over to Daniel.
I'm Daniel Goulden. I'm an assistant editor here at Asymptote.
And Ron.
I'm Ron Karahoda. I'm a composer and music critic.
Who'll be exploring the connection between Georgian language, folklore, and music. But they're going to start with a name that you might just have heard of, Tolkien.
You probably know Tolkien as the author of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Whether you've read these books or seen the movies or steered as far clear as possible, it's pretty hard to ignore the impact of these modern epics on Western culture and beyond. Gollum and Gandalf and the Bagginses are citizens of our collective imagination. Tolkien essentially founded the fantasy genre as we know it. He invented Middle-earth and all its hundreds of inhabitants, and he even coined the word tween, as in the age group of One Direction fans.
Tolkien was an accomplished linguist, folklorist, and translator. He supported the idea of constructed languages, entirely new languages that were supposed to be easy to learn and cross international barriers. But these never caught on. Even though there were widespread constructed language movements in the mid-20th century, the largest one, Esperanto, was never spoken by more than 2 million people.
Tolkien had a theory as to why this was. He said Esperanto was dead, far deader than ancient, unused languages, because authors never invented any Esperanto legends. This is a really interesting idea. The vitality of a language is connected to the vitality of its folklore.
Look at ancient mythology. We still read about the Trojan War in Odysseus's Odyssey, because they are incredibly compelling stories. And because they are so compelling, we still teach and learn ancient Greek in certain parts of the world.
Of course, there are other reasons why a language will or won't survive. Layers and layers of history and luck and politics come into it. But if we look further into the connection between a language and its folklore, what can it tell us about the cultural identity that binds these two together? So to try this out, let's look at one of the most unique folkloric cultures, Georgia.
It's a small country nestled in the Caucasus Mountains, just south of Russia and north of Turkey.
Since the Caucasus Mountains make Georgia a pretty isolated place, the Georgian language is really like nothing else in the world. Georgian is part of the Kartvelian language group, which is completely different from all the major language groups, and it has its own distinct script.
In our rapidly globalizing world, small-scale languages are going extinct at a frightening rate. But Georgian stands out as a counter to that. So why?
Well, a good place to start thinking about this is the country's musical tradition. Georgian is one of the oldest traditions that uses more than one melody at a time.
But it's even more complicated than that. For nearly every dialect, there's an accompanying musical system. I don't mean that there's a different style in every region. That's true of most everywhere. I mean that each one uses a different organization of the scale. It just sounds different from anything in the West.
To learn about Georgian music, we talked to Lysander.
My name is Lysander Jaffe. I am currently a traveling musician.
Lysander just finished up a tour with a choral group, Northern Harmony, and he's been studying Georgian music for years, so he's come to know it pretty well.
There's pretty specific harmonic language that's used that to our ears often sounds very dissonant. There are a lot of clashing seconds, parallel fifths, things that are very frowned upon in the Western classical tradition.
Okay, so to help explain all of this, let's look at some rudimentary music theory. A scale is a defined sequence of notes like the C major scale. When you get to the top, it's called an octave and the scale begins again. Scales like C major use 8 notes that are chosen out of a possible 12 notes.
Those 12 possible notes are mostly convention, but it's a good starting place to talk about how Georgian music is organized. If you listen to this chant from Western Georgia, you can hear how different it is. This chant sounds so different from Western music because it uses notes that sound like they're between those found in the C major scale. In the West, they're called microtones, but in Georgia, they would just call them notes, and without that distinction, their musical vocabulary is very unique. Remember the octave where the scale begins again? In some Georgian scales, that octave tone is a microtone higher than it would be in Western music. This means that each octave sounds higher than the one below it, and each of those has its own flavor.
And the tuning is also quite different. Parts of it sound out of tune to our ears. Often the song will go really sharp, so it will start in one key at the beginning of the song, and then listen to it at the end of the song, you'll be up a whole step or a second or even a third sometimes.
On top of these regional tunings, a major aspect of Georgian folk song is that it's largely a vocal tradition, sung at a communal event like a wedding. Still today, songs are performed with their original lyrics intact, lyrics that tell mythological stories. This means music plays a major role in keeping Georgian language and its folklore alive.
Georgian folktales are just as unique as the music they're set to. There's a frog princess who assists her husband in defeating an evil lord by having him ride a ram through hellfire. There's a student of the devil who escapes his master's clutches by transforming into birds, horses, and household objects. He finally defeats the devil as a needle. He leads the devil, who is transformed into a piece of string, into a fire, burning the devil to bits. Georgian folktales were first studied in depth by Russian ethnographers in the 19th century for mostly imperialist reasons. Then in the 20th century, Georgians began using the study of their folktales to build a national identity. They asked the question, what does it mean to be Georgian? And they found some of the answers in their folktales.
This exploration of national identity extended to their music. And although traditional elements are still central today, modern styles have developed within this musical tradition. So Georgia's older music has maintained a space within contemporary culture, bringing with it the tales that had been set to music.
Folk music is still popular in Georgia today. In fact, just a few months ago, a trio of 3 young women who called themselves the Mandili Trio recorded a video of themselves walking down a mountain singing a Georgian folk tune. The video went viral and has been seen by over 3 million people.
So let's bring this back to Tolkien's idea, that a language lives and breathes through the folklore that underpins it. Tolkien had such strong faith in this idea that he initially wrote The Lord of the Rings as a book of legends to accompany Sindarin, one of the many languages he invented.
This glimpse into Georgia suggests that Tolkien's ideas about language were absolutely right. The Georgian language is far from dead. It's thriving, and this is due in no small part to its legends and its music.
That segment was produced by Daniel Golden and Ron Karahoda, and that concludes our mythology series. Over the course of these two episodes, we've encountered Venezuelan deities, ancient Greek labyrinths, Israeli politics, and Georgian folk music. And in each of these cases, myths have shown themselves to be more than just remnants of the past. There are fantasies and our fears, our memories and our misconceptions. Myths map out the landscape of our imagination. This episode was produced by Yarden Greenspan, Daniel Golden, Ron Karahoda, Kate Nick-Gonal, Florian Dowsons, Mirza Puric, and myself, Emma Jacobs. Special thanks to Gon Ben-Ari, Matty Friedman, Ari Lieberman, Lysander Jaffe, Deborah Harris, Gil Cohen, Joseph Sabo, and Lee Yu Leong. You heard music from Selva Damar, Jazza, the Rastavi Choir, and the Mandili Trio. And just before I go, a few last bits and pieces of Asymptote news. As we work towards the journal's future with our campaign, we also want to celebrate what you've helped us achieve so far. This January is our fourth anniversary, and if you're in London or New York, you can celebrate it with us at our first of this year's live events. There are more details about all that on our Facebook page. We'll also be marking our birthday with a series of blog posts highlighting our favourite projects so far. Visit www.asymptotejournal.com/blog from January 15th onwards to check those out. One of the posts we want to publish is a collection of readers' letters where you can tell us what you enjoy about the site and maybe why you think we're worth donating to. So we'd love to hear from you. Send something our way, between 250 and 1,000 words, and if we publish your letter, you'll win a literary care package, which we usually give away for $125 donations. And there's even more to come, because we're also working on bringing you our January issue. It'll include a new translation of Andrei Platonov by Robert Chandler, Howard Goldblatt's new translation of Wung Ani, an interview with renowned world literature scholar David Damrosch, and a special Danish fiction feature headlined by Dorte Nors and Naya Marie Eid. Those and many more gems will be released on January 30th. We'll be back with more podcast goods soon. And in the meantime, thanks for listening and have a great start to 2015.